Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Dennis Rainey says, there are three relationships we're not naturally good at. God, spouse, and parenting. You agree? I'm Neil Stavem. This is Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls. Ted, I had to think about that. Three relationships we're not naturally good at. God, spouse, and parenting.
I would agree with that. And yeah. I think because it all comes back to selfishness, right?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, obviously, our relationship with God is not naturally good because we're sinful, right? We're fallen. And you know, we were running away from God when God demonstrated his love and sending Christ to die for us. Mm-hmm. Spouse, yeah, we're selfish. Parenting, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. And we're raising, kids that have the same sin disease that we do.
Yeah.
So, all right.
It's true. Even if you read a whole bunch of books on parenting, yeah. You think you're going to do it right and not do it the way the parents did it for me.
Yeah.
I've already found myself sounding like my father.
Well, Dennis said we need help and training, and that's one of the great things that Family Life Today does. This past week, we were down in Little Rock for a couple of days for the 40th anniversary of Family Life Ministries. Mm. The radio program Family Life Today has been on Faith Radio since its beginning, some 25 years ago. And he made some interesting comments and said, for the first time in history in our nation, less than half the population are married.
Wow.
And we are really in some kind of interesting times, aren't we? Dr. Al Mohler was one of the keynote speakers, and he said it'd be hard to find 40 more crucial years in terms of family and marriage than the last 40, mm-hmm. going back to 1976. And he was recounting some of those things. You know, back in 76, well, there had been White House conferences on aging and White House conference on youth, and then there was White House conference on the family. But in 1976, Jimmy Carter was elected. And they changed it to the White House Conference on Families because they didn't want to be, you know, so there's lots of different ways to have families.
Versus just the family.
Yeah. And Dr. Mohler went on to cite all sorts of examples from anthropology to sociology, none of them with the kind of religious framework, and just showing time and time again how important family structure is. And then he made this interesting observation. He said, do we have the inferential wisdom to say maybe this is the way it ought to be?
Mm-hmm.
I wrote that down because I thought, you know, that pretty much sums it up. No one is willing to say this is the way it ought to be. There are no oughts anymore,
You do, you're marginalized and vilified.
That's right. Well, today we're going to talk about relationships and how technology and social media has altered the landscape of the family, faith, social movements, and more. And I know you're going to enjoy our conversation. Dr. Felicia Wu Song will be coming up in just a few minutes. She's been studying. She's a social anthropologist, and we'll get some great insight from her. And I was just thinking, you know, in the midst of these changing times, we could use some biblical wisdom on relationships. And that's the topic of our Memory Verse Monday. Each Monday, we've been sharing a memory verse and some insights from Andy Stanley's from a message some time ago called The Punch List. And today, our verse is from Proverbs 13:20. It's about relationships. He who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm.
Relationships. Boy, this is one every parent needs to teach your kids. He who walks with the wise grows wise, but the companion of fools suffers harm. The reason you struggle with relationships, some of you, is because you think I can handle it. You know, I'm old now. I have this 16-year-old peer pressure thing. It doesn't apply to me. God says wrong. That's just a lie. He who walks with the wise grows wise. The companion of fools suffers harm. The people you surround yourself with will determine the direction and quality of your life, period. That's just the way it is, no matter how old we are. We need to have that simple truth on the tip of our tongue as we make decisions about relationships.
Each Monday, we're just sharing a memory verse, a little bit of insight and encouragement to hide God's word in our hearts. So our verse today, he who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools will suffer harm.
Your friends matter.
Yeah, that's right. And mm-hmm. speaking of walking, don't forget the walking part of that verse. during the month of August. We've just begun the Faith and Fitness Challenge just today.
Yeah, August 1st is upon us, of course, today. And this is where you can still sign up, I think, right? We still have it up at the website, myfaithradio.com. We're helping International Justice Mission put an end to human trafficking, trying to raise $50,000 for this.
So you can sign up, do some fitness challenge, and maybe it's walking or running or biking or swimming or whatever, and you get some friends to connect with you and do the same, and together we can see some funds raised to help fight human trafficking in partnership with International Justice Mission. There's a great video on our website. I encourage you to check that out just to see more about the cause, the fight to end slavery for good, and we want to be a part of it and want to encourage you to be a part of it as well. And we'll kind of keep track of how all of us are doing on our fitness challenge and how our faith is being challenged as well during this month.
MyFaithRadio.com, and you'll see right there on the main page.
We want to hear in just a minute. We'll jump into our conversation with Dr. Felicia Wu-Song, but we always bring you some insights from John Stone Street on the point, and John today has a story that was recently on CBS about, someone overcoming disabilities. And sometimes you just need a little good news. We've had plenty of the other recently. So let's give a listen to The Point and then stay tuned for a conversation on social media.
Go Tigers! For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. A recent CBS News story portrayed in a powerful way that every human life at every stage of life is beautiful and bears the image of God. Reporter Steve Hartman introduced a young man named Ryan Holcomb who has Down syndrome. Unlike 90% of babies diagnosed with Downs in utero, Ryan was born. But like many South Carolinians, he longed to go to Clemson University, a tall order to say the least. With his parents' encouragement, Ryan applied to Clemson's competitive two-year program for young people with learning disabilities to prepare them for independence and employment. He got in, and now Ryan has graduated, and unlike so many recent college graduates, he has a job in hand. Okay, I'll admit, I got a lump in my throat watching this report, and though I'm a big Duke basketball fan, today I trade in my Duke t-shirt for a Clemson Tiger Paul. If you'd like to see the CBS story, come to breakpoint.org, and I'll link you to it. With today's point, I'm John Stone Street.
We're going to talk about the digital technology and social media and its impact and effect on family and society and religion, a number of those things. We're happy to have with us today Dr. Felicia Wu-Song, who's a cultural sociologist studying the impact of digital technologies on identity, community, and relationships. She's an associate professor and chair of the Sociology and Anthropology Department at Westmont College and has a keen interest in what's evolving in the social media industry and how, you know, as we adopt and use digital technology, how it's altering the landscape of family, religion, advertising, social movements, mass media. All that. We're going to get into that. Welcome, Felicia. First of all, it's wonderful to have you on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So maybe just by way of kind of background, probably should just define some things. I guess people that are using digital technology and social media, you know, understand what it's all about. But talk a little bit about some of the area of your study and in interest.
Sure. So I began my studies back in the early 2000s when the word on the street in the realm of digital technology was virtual communities. Mm-hmm. And those were websites with moderated forums where people would go online and meet other people and talk about a particular topic, whether it was religion or the experience of being women or whatever it might be. But as everyone knows, since Facebook hit the scene, social media has taken off, and that includes Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, Twitter, all of that has really fundamentally changed how we interact with each other online, and it's not just with people we don't know, but very often it's more with people who we do know. And then in addition to social media platforms, the other major variable is mobile, the development of the iPhone, and then the introduction of tablets that has meant that technology moves with us. It's not just on our desks. And so those are the broad technologies that drive my interest.
Are there a couple of primary ways or things that, you know, how social media and technologies have affected, that maybe we'll just start with family and we can broaden it out the culture, or, you know, even get into expressing our faith as well. But what are some of the maybe the big ways that we see it changing us?
Yeah, the areas that I've looked at with regards to family have primarily been concerning the impact of internet and digital technology on the experience of contemporary motherhood, and even more broadly, parenthood, as people enter into parenthood, how their capacity to find information about all the changes that are coming down their pike in their own lives or in their babies' lives has exponentially broadened beyond the people that they know to just a multitude of websites. And for women especially, that has shifted their relationships with their doctors, their relationships with their families and friends, and even their own understanding of pregnancy, birthing, and early parenthood. So I think even in people's fundamental experiences of moving into parenthood, just the beginning of family, so to speak, there are these new expectations that you would become very informed on your own about what's happening with your body, what's going to happen with your baby's body and their development. And now you have increasingly parents, obviously there were books that told us all these things before the internet, but especially when you're dealing with pregnancy complications or if you know that your child has some sort of health risk, these new parents have access to so much more information, and it can potentially change that dynamic with your healthcare provider. The other part that is also really interesting is that it potentially sets up an expectation that parents be informed. That is, if you don't know what exactly is going on with your child, if you're not sure, there may be a suggestion among your peers or others that, well, maybe you're not being a responsible parent, that maybe you should be online, right, Googling it, looking it up, and you should know more. And so there's interesting expectations, I think, that are built around the availability of the information.
You know, one of the areas I know that you have focused a lot on, you can call it mommy bloggers, and I guess after the child is born, and, you know, that the moms are relating their life experience. But has that changed sort of maybe how we value moms or how moms sort of look at their value within a society that oftentimes is all about the work and career?
Yeah, so the mommy blogging phenomenon is fascinating because that also has just had an incredible ripple effect across, I think, the country for upper middle class mothers, and especially if they're stay-at-home mothers. As readers, right, they're able to access other mothers' experiences that are often extremely honest and authentic, talking about perhaps the more embarrassing or even taboo experiences or topics that come with motherhood. And those are often conversations that aren't had in standard parenting magazines or books, and perhaps not in church Bible studies or coffee hours. And so I think there's a lot of mothers out there that are finding resonance and finding community in these online spaces by virtue of reading mommy blogs. But certainly there are thousands of mommy bloggers, so, you know, women who are finding voice, trying to give voice. And the group that I've studied aren't the mommy bloggers who simply post pictures and update, you know, their extended family about their family details. But these are women who have really gone from blogging as a hobby to blogging as a profession, and realizing that their experiences actually has economic potential, or as the industry call it, they can monetize their blog with advertising or sponsors, and the blogging industry itself has gone through its own evolution. So it's interesting to see how these professional mom bloggers are carving out their own identity as entrepreneurs, as businesswomen, really, and renegotiating their identity, that they are more than mothers, They may be experts in disability. They may be experts in recovering from alcohol and parenting, right? They might be experts in fashion, right, or in community organizing, and that they can share those experiences and share that wisdom with other women who really connect and really are hungering for that type of real community. It's out there. And my experience of meeting these women at conferences is that this is for real, and they're very serious in really positive ways.
We're going to continue talking a little bit more about that. I want to find out, you know, what does community look like in this world of digital technology and social media, and to talk a little bit about monetizing some of those things as well. I want to talk about, you know, you're a parent wondering about your child's apparent addiction to their, their mobile device. How do we respond to that? All those things and more we'll get into with Dr. Felicia Wu-Song, who's a cultural sociologist and associate professor and chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Westmont College, joining us today here on Connecting Faith. Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. With me today, Dr. Felicia Wu-Song, who is associate professor and chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Westmont College. She's a cultural sociologist, been studying the impact of digital technologies on identity, community, and relationships. And we're talking about the issues like mommy bloggers, and maybe a phrase you're not aware of, but we want to get into some of the issues. Is there a way that we can look at a biblical worldview as we see the use of these technologies increasing all the time? And, Felicia, I wanted to go back a bit because you talked about finding community. That's maybe one of the questions we have about social media and digital technology use. I mean, is it really community? How do you define community in a faith setting as well? If there's a church faith component where we, in theory, should be all about community, but or has this just become here's another opportunity to kind of build a home-based business kind of thing, and that we still, even though we're moms, but we still have business skills kind of thing.
Yeah, you touch on exactly the tension that is there in the mom blogosphere, that so many women start attracted and drawn into the blogging endeavor because it is such an authentic and communal experience. And at the same time, there is the commercial element. There is the business building and the commodification of that authenticity and the commodification of community, right? Corporate sponsors that are excited that this mom blogger has 5,000 followers, and maybe if we can get her to review this product, then they've just, reached 5,000 other women. And I think the women themselves are caught in that tension, and they talk about it a lot, that there is always this danger of selling out, of betraying the community for the sake of the business, right, building. So I think that's a real tension, and that's also what I find really interesting about it. Yeah.
And is it a problem if our social media is monetized? I mean, if there's all sorts of algorithms, so Google or whatever is going to sort of move us in a direction based on what we've maybe searched or looked at before. I mean, what are some concerns with that kind of model? I guess because we're probably not fully aware of how much we are being influenced.
Eli Pariser wrote a book called The Filter Bubble and did a TED Talk on this very topic that I think is really one of the best. And he talks about how the algorithms in Google and Facebook that determine what information we get, right? That is, what posts we actually find coming to the top of our feeds, or what search results, right, we find when we Google some keywords are all the results of our previous searches and our previous likes on Facebook, and very much not showing us, right, that the algorithms are not showing us the whole universe of the information that is out there. And he does this great example of where he shows his Facebook feed and a friend's Facebook feed. And I'm sorry, it was their Google searches, Google searching, and how they Google searched the same keywords, but they came up with completely different search results, which was fascinating, right? Because that then shows you, and I think that the keywords were like Egypt and Cairo during the time of Arab Spring. And it just shows you how we, as you mentioned, as consumers of information, very often we do not realize, and certainly Google doesn't tell us this, right, that this information is filtered and we are very much in a bubble. And to get out of that bubble, right, is actually extremely difficult. And on Facebook, if we like or spend time on the posts that are more perhaps conservative, politically conservative and leaning, then Facebook will tend to show us those posts more than the more politically liberal ones, even if we want to see them, right? Mm-hmm. It just automatically filters it without telling us. And that I think is actually really problematic.
And I guess it's a problem for all of us, but maybe certainly we think about our kids using it and maybe not as discerning. I mean, we obviously have some discernment questions too, but yeah. It's maybe more so a concern for our children too, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's really the new area of research that is opening up wide, is that we have parents. This generation of parents is the first generation that is raising children in a completely mobile technology saturated society, and what that means or what that looks like is really uncertain. But there is really good research that's coming out. Sherry Turkle has written extensively about her own concerns about young people's use of texting and social media and how that impacts the ways that their identities form or impacts the way that they form relationships and understand what friendships are. And even in the parent-child relationship, there are ways in which our social medias and our mobile devices connect us in ways that are really different, not only from face-to-face interactions, but also from phone, voice conversations.
How do we live and navigate in this completely mobile society, particularly for our children? We're reflecting on some of those cultural questions with cultural sociologist Dr. Felicia Wu Song, looking at some of the impact of digital technologies on identity, community, and relationships. She's an associate professor and chair of sociology and anthropology at Westmont College. And joining us today on Connecting Faith, and we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. To Connecting Faith, we're connected today with Dr. Felicia Wu Song. We're talking actually about connections, about the digital technology and social media that affects family and in so many areas of our culture, and what that really looks like. Felicia is a associate professor and chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Westmont College. Felicia, I know there's probably some moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas listening that are just wondering, all right, my children, my grandchildren seem like, I mean, they can't get away from their mobile device. You're a mom. Are there some things that you kind of put in place and say, well, here's what I did. I don't know if this is the right way, but here's some of the framework that we tried to build in terms of guardrails.
Yeah, that's a great question. and I'm very much in process on this one. So, you know, one of the things that I think is the hardest for us parents is how are we using our technologies? That it really begins there. You know, we all know that our children absorb through osmosis what we, you know, they learn from what we do rather than what we say. And so if the question, I think, always starts with, well, what type of technological practices am I modeling to my children? Do I turn it off when I, you know, am at the dinner table? Do I not leap up and run to it when the text ping occurs, right? Do I demonstrate to them that this technology is not the master, right, of me, so that they can begin to imagine for themselves what it could look like for them. And so I think it really just starts with the parents' own practices. What I do, I've actually just recently decided that I'm going to change my email habits. I don't know how you or your listeners deal with your email inbox, but I was sort of chronically at its beck and call for a while. And that's just overwhelming. It's fatiguing, and it feels like your job never stops. And so I decided that I'm going to set particular times in the day, once or twice a day, where I will batch task my emails, that is, respond, you know, check and respond to my emails in batches. And I'll have in my signature, these are the times that I check my emails, right? Mm-hmm. So people will know and begin to remember what it is like to live without a constant checking. And I think it's the same thing with our mobile devices, is trying to figure out settings that will help us, you know, when it's dinner time or if it's past 8 o'clock, that it's just off, right? And that only the emergency calls or you know, the close family members' calls will come through. As for our children, their own habits, I think a lot of it is about conversation and being smart about the technologies that we allow them access to. I think there are a lot of parents that just feel like it's an unavoidable wave or a train that you can't turn back, because everyone has the device, everyone expects you to text, the schools expect you to have phones, and I think that's a real challenge. But I think for parents, and especially Christian parents, I think there's space, right, to have conversations with our children and not actually start with rules. I think that's where we want to run to, right? Yeah. Kind of set the boundaries, set up the fences and the walls and everything. The thing I've been thinking about more is, as Christian parents, maybe we should start with conversations with our children about what is our identity based on? You know, what forms our identity? You know, what is true friendship? What is it that we're really looking for in our conversations with our friends or staying connected with our friends? What is it that we long for? What does that look like? And start with a whole picture, right, of our humanity in our identities, in our relationships with each other. Fill that vision, right? Create a vision of something that's truly compelling and rich and thick. And then say, okay, now we have these devices that allow these particular ways to communicate. Now, how does this fit, right? How does this fit into this vision that we've just talked about? And then it gets interesting, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully the child and the parent can together work on saying, hey, you know, God created us as embodied beings. You know, we want to feel connected. We don't want to feel like we're missing out, but where is our identity ultimately rooted? Is it in knowing every pop cultural reference and keeping up with every small thing that's happening, or is our identity rooted somewhere else? Can we have confidence in that? And I think it's creating that larger vision that is truly compelling, that's where the power is going to be for the parents and the child. to resist the tendencies that we all have, I think, when we're bored or we're sad or feeling lonely, to just kind of run to our devices and while away our time, you know, scanning through our Facebook feeds.
It's always, the lifelong, the daily challenge, isn't it, to sort of see ourselves in the bigger picture of God's story, and that catching a clear vision of, you know, His design for us and plans and purposes for us, because we, as you say, we can sort of run to the rules and the systems and all those things, and that we need a little framework help.
That's right. And I think it's that framework that is, I believe, what animates or gives power to whatever rules we end up agreeing with. Because the rules on their own can quickly become a power struggle, I think, between parents and children. But if there is a shared understanding, or at least an animating vision that says, you know, there is a much more rich and embodied experience of relationship that God has promised for us, why would we want to live these impoverished lives that are only so narrowly distributed through texts? Then it becomes much more compelling. And I think the other part of the equation, which I think is the really interesting one for the church, is that I think these sorts of technological practices have to be communal. That is, it's hard, right? We all know it's really hard to swim against the stream when we're the only one. And certainly for a young person, right, when all of their friends are texting, when they're all on Snapchat, if they're all doing something, then they're being left out. It's very difficult. What I'm interested in is, you know, what are the possibilities for communities, groups of people to get together and say, hey, you know, all of our kids are the same age, or they're friends, right? How about we all, in some way, I don't know if you want to use the word covenant, whatever word you want to use, right, agree to, let's just hold off on this, right? Let's hold off on the mobile phones together. Let's hold off on the Snapchat together. And then your child, you know, our children aren't going to feel left out, because all their friends, or, you know, their close ones at least, are also not online. And I think it is in that collective practice that is very possible in our youth groups, in our communities, in our neighborhoods, that there can also be just great amounts of power there.
Hopefully, I guess the youth pastors, the Christian education workers, I mean, the ministry teams that are encouraging us in our parenting, in our life, and our kids can help us maybe just talk through those questions and reinforce that too, right? So we're not just kind of on our own. And communal has been at the heart of our faith journey anyway. And so we do need encouragement along the way, no question about it.
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of my thinking is framed by the work that Jamie Smith, a philosopher at Calvin, has written on. He's written on Augustine's view of what it is that really shapes us, right? And shapes our hearts, shapes our loves. And he says it's not about the things we believe, it's not about the things we know, but it is actually what we do that is like the actual practices that we engage in that end up ultimately shaping our hearts. And he uses the language of liturgy very powerfully to talk about this, right? So liturgy in a kind of practice ritual form, but also liturgy in terms of, right, the definition of liturgy, which is worship of the people, right? What's something that we do together, that when we practice together, right, certain habits, that really can form our loves, right? Form our understanding of what true relationship can be, what true love and friendship can look like. And to me, that's just a really exciting vision that has the substance that can push up against the pressures and the tendencies, I think, that we all have with our technological devices.
There's no question that, you know, pursuing the right kind of habits are going to pay dividends. I mean, the spiritual disciplines have been reminding us of that for many centuries. So a good word.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that's where, you know, Jamie Smith, he talks about secular liturgies, that you know, everyone has liturgy in their life. It just depends on whether it's religious liturgy or secular liturgy. And he talks about technology as being a type of secular liturgy. And Sherry Turkle, a psychologist at MIT, she wrote a book, Alone Together, where she actually writes about a friend who wakes up in the morning and the first thing that she does is check her email and check her social media feeds. And I'm sure many of us do the same. And what strikes me about that example is that, you know, framed within the context of liturgy, you know, it actually becomes very poignant. We think about evangelical Christians often, or at least traditionally, thinking of our mornings, right, waking up and praying and reading the Bible, right, that those are the liturgies that we should be engaged in. But perhaps instead, somehow, without our even realizing it, it's become our email and in our Facebook feeds. And that means that, you know, that in the end, you know, it accrues to something substantive about who we are and who we are becoming.
So what does it mean to sort of live in a completely mobile society and seeing digital technology influences so strongly? We've been talking about it today with Dr. Felicia Wu Song. She's associate professor and chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Westmont College, and we're honored to have her with us today on Connecting Faith. Felicia, thank you for helping us just sort of think through the issues, raising some questions, and kind of pointing us in some new directions to look and apply.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've been listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll continue with more in just a moment. Where a lot of us live today, isn't it? The wandering gaze, as Dr. Song was just talking about, how our morning liturgy has sort of suddenly become, you know, we get up and check the devices mm-hmm. as opposed to getting into God's Word. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's true. A bit convicting. I mean, sometimes they'll say, well, I'll do my devotions,
sure.
but first let me just, you know.
Sure, check in that. Well, yes, we want to help our kids develop some good habits as well, and there's a great new book out, just came out, called 52 Ways to connect with your smartphone-obsessed kids.
Oh, man.
And, you know, in fact, I mentioned last week I was down in Little Rock at the Family Life Ministries 40th anniversary, and in the airport, there was a granddad there taking his granddaughter on a trip, and she was, I'm guessing, 5 or 6, not much older than that, and he was trying to help her. He's trying to figure out how to operate her smartphone.
Oh,
so she
man.
Wanted to see something. Like, wow, that seems pretty young.
Pretty young, yeah.
Pretty young.
Oh, wow, and it's those early habits that that develop, you know, that you can't really undo. It really takes a lot of time to try and undo them.
Well, we have some practical advice today. I hope that you were interested in the conversation with Dr. Felicia Song. But we also have a few tips that we can share from this new resource.
I'm really looking forward to hearing this. I'm going to be taking notes.
Talking with Jonathan McKee about a new book called 52 Ways to Connect with Your Smartphone-Obsessed Kid. Jonathan is the president of the Source for Youth Ministry. He's author of 20 books, including More Than Just the Talk, The Guy's Guide to God, Girls and the Phone in Your Pocket, as well as youth ministry books and a number of resources. But Jonathan, you know, we probably don't have time to get through all 52 ways, but I mean, the fact is that our kids are pretty obsessed with their smartphones, aren't they?
They are. There's all kinds of studies out there. Common Sense Media actually just did a recent survey where they not only asked parents, where, of course, the majority of parents thought, my kids spent too much time on these devices, but even 52% of young people said, wow, I think I agree. We're spending too much time on our mobile devices. So there's kind of this sense out there. And this is, let's be honest, I mean, think about this. This is kind of a relatively new technology historically. It wasn't until 2012 that America crossed the 50% mark for smartphone ownership. So a lot of us have these devices in our pockets. Most research is showing that teenagers are spending up to 9 hours a day on entertainment, media, and technology. Actually, it's not up to that, my correction here. That's an average of 9 hours a day on entertainment, media, and technology. So we're absorbing tons of this stuff. It's affecting us. And the one thing that I think parents are finding is they're saying, man, it's affecting conversation around the house. So much of time is as we walk home and everybody's staring at their devices, and I wish there was more conversation. So that's what this book is about, is being able to look for these moments where we can have some real face-to-face conversation, where sometimes young people are looking, prying their eyes away from their devices and engaging in some good conversation.
Now, the kids are probably saying, well, I don't know why my folks are getting on my case so much because, you know, I'm not out doing drugs or that kind of thing. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, and honestly, a lot of kids are also saying, Mom, Dad, you're a hypocrite. You're staring at this stuff as much as we are. And honestly, the research out there shows that parents are actually spending more time staring at some of these screens than young people. And I know parents might find it hard to find, but when you look at, for instance, TV, for sure my age group, the age group of parents today, spending more time than teenagers watching that, and our parents, the teenagers' grandparents, spending even more time staring at that big screen. So you walk in a typical restaurant and you look around and you see moms and dads all the time sitting in the booth staring at their devices. Matter of fact, if you walk in a typical home today, you'd see the adults are staring at the TV. Teenagers are staring at like a mobile device or a laptop, probably streaming Netflix. Toddlers flicking colored shapes across the screen of the, you know, new iPad, and the dog's on the treadmill because no one walks him. I mean, this is what the American home looks like today. So, yeah, it's one of those tough scenarios where parents need to first model this. And then they need to, needed to show that, hey, I can put this down. Like, for example, one of the 52 ways would be what I call no tech at the table. It's a simple thing where in the house you just establish, guess what? Family dinner time is going to be something we're going to cherish. And let's, mom and dad included, put the tech down. And when we eat dinner, we don't have technology out. It's just a time where we engage in conversation. Does that guarantee you beautiful geysers of conversation every dinner? No. But, you know, it might take 5 dinners or 6 dinners before a good conversation happens. But you know that the table is a safe place where conversation happens. And we as parents, we need to start looking out for these places and maybe even sometimes using boundaries, realistic boundaries, like saying no tech at the table, because that can create these bonding moments.
Well, we don't have time to get to all 52, but are there some categories or general things or maybe your top five favorite tips? I mean, the no tech at the table, that's a great idea. What other kind of general ideas can we hang on to?
Oh, so many different ones talking about looking for these moments, and not all of them are necessarily putting tech away. One of the best moments I had communicating with my son growing up was when he was playing video games. And what that would look like in a typical home is, I mean, think about how many times we walk in and our son's playing video games, and the first thing we want to say is, hey, have you done your 2 hours today? Or, you know, are you at your limit? Turn that thing off. And instead of saying turn that thing off, maybe sitting down with him and saying, hey, cool sword. Where'd you get it? Hey, where'd you get that hood? Can I try? And sitting down and playing games with the person playing games right there, your son or your daughter. I found that my time sitting down playing games with my son, he talked to me probably more than he ever talked to me because I was taking time to get into his world. And we as parents sometimes can use that. We can look for those moments. Some of these moments are moments where technology is put away. We're putting our kid to bed and the phone is in the charger and your kid looks up from under the sheets and says, Dad, Mom, you know, when you were my age, did anybody ever talk about you and say something untrue? And next thing you know, you're having this amazing conversation with your kid for maybe just 5 to 10 minutes before they're going to bed. There's moments like that where technology is put away. But sometimes there's moments with technology. This is the kind of stuff we're looking for and trying to find those moments where we maximize conversation.
Because it is here, and we need to make some adjustments in the way that we parent and communicate.
Absolutely. And there's all kinds of moments where if we take the time to look into their world and find the things that interest them and ask them questions. And that's why I try to fill this book with just all kinds of ideas to open up these arenas of communication.
Good word, Jonathan. Thank you for your work in this area and for your encouragement that we can still communicate with our kids.
Yeah, well, I hope you guys enjoy the book, 52 Ways to Connect with Your Smartphone-Obsessed Kid. It's on Amazon or it's on sourceforparents.com.
Again, that website is thesourceforparents.com, the number four, thesourceforparents.com. Check it out, and we'll tell you about tomorrow's show coming up in a minute.
Prayer has been a huge part of my life, no way around it.
Prayer. For musician Jason Baer, it's one of his earliest memories. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count, and seeing his dad's example really has had an influence on Jason's life.
Having my dad pastor in a church, taking a small church somewhere in the backwoods of North Carolina, the last member left 2 weeks before we came, and he would take me and my brother to the church with him, and he would go out there, and all night he would lay on the floor on his face and he would pray and cry out to God. I've seen my dad do that so many times over my life, and what I saw more importantly was God answered those prayers. So that's when I knew, if you do this, then there's going to be an outcome. Because God is a God that listens, He's a God that hears, and He's a God that sees.
Remember, God loves you and offers a wonderful plan for your life. So talk to Him all the time.
Reminder,
Steve Douglas.
Sorry, Steve, a reminder that we have a prayer team here at Faith Radio. We'd love to have you be a part of it. James 5:16. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man or woman accomplishes much. You can sign up for the Faith Radio prayer team. And get a weekly prayer email at myfaithradio.com/prayer, myfaithradio.com/prayer. Hope you've had a good reflection time today as we talk about social media and its influence kind of our culture and society, including Jonathan McKee's great tips on the smartphone-obsessed kid. You can hear the full conversation today if you go to our website, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's a place where you can always hear the podcasts, the interviews. You can also share them with a friend, too. We'd love for you to do that. But tomorrow, hope that you can be with us. So we're going to talk about more, how to move from activity for God to intimacy with God. You know, Ted, I think probably a lot of us at times were wondering, is there more to life? You know, and is there more to our relationship with God? And we all go through seasons where we wonder about that. Well, Greg Hawkins has done some research, and actually it's some 500,000 members in churches across the North America have taken this this Reveal study. And out of that, he draws some great insights on how we can experience a more active and engaged faith, which, of course, is our passion here at Faith Radio.
Yeah, no matter where you're at in your faith journey, we can always use that extra encouragement to go a little deeper with God. That'll
so
be good.
The topic with Greg Hawkins tomorrow, more, how to move from activity for God to intimacy with God. I hope that you'll join us right here on Faith Radio. We'll see you tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Check out the website, myfaithradio.com.